I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with my old friend Danny Goldberg, and y'all know Danny because he had a show here for some time, and he appears often on Be Here Now Network in one way or the other with whoever. And Danny, welcome. Great to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here now.
Yeah. I asked Danny to do this with me when I heard of the death of John Lewis, a congressman who died just a few days ago. And Danny has been very close to the whole historical civil rights issues and the people, of course. Danny's who isn't, in a way, of a devotee of Dr. Martin Luther King. But Danny has spent a lot of time in his own private life, basically, as well as somewhat public life, focused around the work of Dr. King. So I thought, okay, let's do something. The caveat is we're two white guys, but in a way, you know, we're also two humans, and we have such huge appreciation, especially for the work of these men who and women who really went so far to change the culture of this country. And of course, we're in the middle of that roiling itself, quite largely through, of course, the death of George Floyd. So Danny, maybe, you know, I thought it would be great. You always do so great with me. Now, I'm from Canada, so there is a little bit of a difference in terms of how I grew up. Actually, I wanted to tell you that we did, because of the foundation, Love Serve, Remember, we have been educating ourselves. We actually did a little seminar last weekend with the person, Robin, who wrote White Fragility. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with that book?
I'm familiar with it. I have not read it, but I'm well aware of the book, and it's on my list.
Yeah. It's pretty great. So it allowed me to see some of the differences with where I grew up, because one of the questions was, did you grow up in, was that a mixed neighborhood? If not, where was, where, how far away from you was the neighborhood? Were you going to school, a multiracial situation? None of it applied to me. I'd never even, I actually did not. The only time when I was, I remember 9 or 10 years old, taking the train with my cousin going from Montreal to Toronto, and the porters were black. And I later found out that that was one of the few jobs that the very few African, well, Canadians, but black people could do back then. And my introduction actually was mostly around because I was so much into jazz that there were a couple of clubs in Montreal. And this was later when I was a teenager. So I have it pointed to me that a little bit of a difference in terms of my relationship with black community. But, you know, I thought it would be great if you just a little bit of historical perspective on how this all got created. I mean, I, you know, in my education, recently, one of the most wild things that the Pope in 1600s or 1700s gave his benediction to the Portuguese government to allow slavery to go forward. And all they asked for was they wanted them to be converted and they wanted a bounty for every head. And that was the one of the antecedents to this horror. But yeah, a little bit of historical perspective might be good.
Well, I just thinking about John Lewis in particular, since it's his passing that's kind of the catalyst for this conversation. Yeah. Although it's worth noting that the same day that John Lewis passed, C.T. Vivian, who was also a very close colleague of Dr. King's, very much committed to nonviolence, also passed away. He was, I think, about 10 or 12 years older than John Lewis. John Lewis was 80, and I think C.T. Vivian was somewhere in his 90s. And I couldn't help but think that, you know, because I really think of Dr. King, John Lewis, C.T. Vivian, Andrew Young, many others whose names are not at my tips, but a few dozen, mostly very young people. You know, Dr. King was 26 or 27 when the Montgomery bus boycott happened. John Lewis was 17 when he first met Dr. King. And they were kind of, to me, the equivalent of the founding fathers of the United States in terms of these young people who did things that were so revolutionary and so important. And of course, you know, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson also passed away on exactly the same day. And, you know, there is I don't want to belabor the comparison, especially given the fact that most of the founding fathers were slave owners. Adams was not, but Jefferson was. But this generation of young people, I mean, the Civil Rights Revolution, which at least legally ended the previous 100 years of what loosely has been called Jim Crow, which was legal racial segregation enforced and upheld by law, which was ended by the Civil Rights Act in the mid-60s and with some additional help from the Voting Rights Act that came after it. Of course, the Voting Rights Act has now been pushed back by both the U.S. Supreme Court and the intransigence of Republicans in the Senate. But still, the Civil Rights Movement, one key milestone was the passage of those laws in the mid-60s. And that was a revolution after 100 years of legal segregation. And it was done by these young people. There were older African-Americans who'd fought this battle for many, many, many decades, and most famously, the NAACP had a series of lawsuits, and they played an incredibly important historical role and without the NAACP and without litigation, without people like Thurgood Marshall, who first became known as the lead attorney for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and then later was on the U.S. Supreme Court himself as the first African-American member. But I don't believe any of that would have happened without this movement that was driven by these younger people, that just arguing the law was not enough. They needed this mass movement. And the purpose of the mass movement, I think, was to change the consciences and therefore the political will of white people, because certainly African Americans all along were against all of the racist policies, whether it was legal or just cultural, that put them at such a disadvantage even after slavery was abolished. It was changing the political reality among a politically salient number of whites that created the political climate for finally at least those laws to be passed. And I think there's a mirror of that in terms of the demonstrations after the murder of George Floyd, in which, thank God, enough white people have changed their opinions so that people in government are feeling pressure from a politically relevant majority, because, there's still, more whites than, any other group in this country. But King again was I think 26 when he first went to Montgomery to be the preacher of the church there after he got out of his graduate work. And within the first few months of him being there, Rosa Parks, refused to sit in the back of the bus. The Montgomery bus boycott happened, and that triggered what we think of as the civil rights revolution that sort of starts in the mid-50s. And a culmination, certainly not the culmination, because we haven't resolved the issues of racism in this society yet, but a significant step forward takes 10 years, between Montgomery bus boycott and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And, John Lewis, there's a documentary that's on a bunch of the streaming services.
I just saw it. It's
that
fantastic.
I just watched.
You did? Yeah.
And, I knew we were going to have this conversation, so I thought it would be kind of lame not to see it.
Yeah.
To do is push a button and pay $3 or $4 to rent it. And, the idea that at 17, he writes a letter to King and so inspired by him because of the Montgomery bus boycott, and King sends him a round trip bus ticket from Troy, Georgia to Montgomery and to meet him. And that in a very short length of time, Lewis became a key advisor and then was the president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee when he was 21 years old. That was referred to usually by the acronym SNCC. And those words, nonviolent, to me have a holy meaning in the context of all of this. And Dr. King had studied in college the works of Gandhi, who was a great inspiration to him, and Niebuhr, and Henry David Thoreau, and many other people, Emerson, who had written about nonviolence. The example of India, obviously, was the most famous one. But him and John Lewis in particular, and C.T. Vivian certainly, never wavered in their commitment to nonviolence. And it was often expressed as the wisest tactic, because King would often talk about, we're a minority in this country. It's just simply not practical to think that we could possibly physically prevail in any kind of armed conflict. Mm. It's not going to work. It's not going to make anyone's lives better. So putting it, and that was an important argument, and it was a tactic, but it was also a deeply held spiritual belief. You can't listen to John Lewis's many, many speeches or Dr. King's many sermons and speeches, because Dr. King was as much of a spiritual leader as he was a civil rights leader in terms of his legacy, in my view of things. And that was connected with people like older American pacifists like A.J. Mustey, and British pacifists like Bertrand Russell, who had a deep spiritual ethical belief that that was the way human beings had to behave to achieve change, even if it was painful. And you know, I recently also rewatched the Gandhi movie.
Oh yeah,
which I think holds up pretty well. And of course, that was not a particularly popular philosophy when Gandhi introduced it in India. To you know, there's a huge rage at the British, and also a lot of violence between Muslims and Hindus. Unfortunately, the latter problem has not gone away. And he would say, "Yeah, nonviolence hurts, and people get hurt, but people get hurt in any kind of a conflict. It's not like people don't get hurt in a violent conflict. It's a question of what is the right thing to do, what creates the right residue and context for a decent society, what is the spiritually right thing to do, and what's actually going to be effective when you're dealing with the imbalance of physical power and economic power, which is the case. And John Lewis never wavered from this. In fact, when he was 22 or 23, when Malcolm X's popularity was growing in the African-American community, Stokely Carmichael ran against him to be president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and beat him. And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was no longer committed to nonviolence, but John Lewis stayed committed to it. And you know, I saw there's a historian named John Meekham who's apparently working on a book about Lewis that's going to come out, I guess, in the fall. And he was on one of the TV shows, and he said, and he spent a lot of time with Lewis in the last years of his life, interviewing him in the context of the book. And he said, Lewis never got over his pain at being rejected by SNCC, even though he became a U.S. congressman and served for over 30 years in the United States Congress, and was praised rightfully so by everyone from President Obama to there is no modern American politician who didn't have good things to say about John Lewis. He was beloved. Even John McCain loved John Lewis. There were Republican Congress people who loved John Lewis. He had radiated a decency that transcended politics, even though he was very unwavering ideologically. But he apparently never really got over the feeling of disappointment and rejection and pain from that. And, you know, it's such a good lesson, because most of us have had rejection in our life from one way or another. I certainly have. And, you know, the trick is not to pretend it doesn't hurt. The trick is to get over it, you know, not in terms of not feeling the pain anymore, but not letting it dominate your self-definition or what you do in the future. And boy, John Lewis, what an example of someone who, quote unquote, had this huge loss at the age of 22 or 23. And then, you know, that was in the 1960s, and he doesn't enter Congress until 1987. So it's not like he just went
boom, boom,
from strength to strength, as some of our, you know, the rabbis say. He spent 20 years just staying committed to his beliefs in a sort of unglamorous way, and then reemerges as this, they called him the conscience of the House of Representatives, where he served for, you know, 30, the better part of 33 years, you know.
Yeah.
So just a beautiful being, he radiated beauty. I didn't ever get to know him, but I did meet him a couple of times, and he just had that vibe that beautiful souls have. And kind of was able to be incredibly pragmatic about politics, strategic, tactical, and effective, without losing the innocence and sweetness of a spiritual person. And we don't get a lot of examples of that inside one human being in our society. And he was one of them. And really just beautiful to think about him. Even though, as much as it's a drag he's not on the planet, it's also an excuse to reflect on a beautiful soul and a beautiful energy that is still on the planet.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when you talk about holy in terms of nonviolence and all of the philosophical resonance that has, and the fact that it's just at its core spiritual, that I picked up this thing that's an excerpt from John Lewis's book, Across That Bridge, A Vision for Change and the Future of America. Let me just read this, because I think our listeners, obviously, I focus a lot, mostly on consciousness, still do some stuff around what's going on in our social lives, and a lot of that with you. And I think this is important because for me, I knew John Lewis, the congressman, and I'd see him on television. I knew John Lewis, who was close to Dr. King, but I really didn't have a breath, the wide breadth of who this man is and the deep core spirituality that he is. And the more I started to get into it when he left, just in the last few days, it's just, he's pretty extraordinary being. So this is something from this book. He said, "You are a light. You are the light. Never let anyone, any person or any force dampen, dim, or diminish your light. Study the path of others to make your way easier and more abundant. Lean toward the whispers of your own heart. Discover the universal truth and follow its dictates. Release the need to hate, to harbor division, and the enticement of revenge. Release all bitterness. Hold only love, only peace in your heart, knowing that the battle of good to overcome evil is already won. Choose confrontation wisely, but when it is your time, do not be afraid to stand up, and speak out against injustice. And if you follow your truth down the road to peace and the affirmation of love, if you shine like a beacon for all to see, then the poetry of all the great dreamers and philosophers is yours to manifest in a nation, a world community, and a beloved community that is finally at peace with itself."
Beautiful. So, what is that from, Raghu?
That is from Across the Bridge, A Vision for Change and the Future of America, a book, I'm assuming it's a book that he wrote.
That he wrote. Well, yeah. Just beautiful. I'm not surprised, but it's so beautiful. And to hear that kind of idea and energy coming from an elected official doesn't happen all that often. And, just incredible. No, it's an unbelievable, the contributions of African Americans to this culture and to world culture coming out of such a horrible oppression, both through slavery and through the post-slavery racism. And yet the amount of saintly beauty a lot of it is rooted in Christianity, and it's easy to see why your guru and many others of different traditions also saw Jesus as being part of the same cosmic truth, because when people are really tuned into that energy, they come out sounding like John Lewis.
Yeah, but it's not, I just read some beautiful words that he wrote. And then he it was action about him.
The famous march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and Edmund Pettus was some Confederate racist. There's now a movement to try to change the name of the bridge to the John Lewis Bridge, which I hope happens. But no, he was beaten and bloody, and I think his skull was cracked. And of course, many people in the civil rights movement, less famous, many of them were murdered. The three civil rights workers famously in Mississippi. And many, many, many others, and hundreds more were beaten. There's an incredible film of C.T. Vivian, who I mentioned earlier, talking to an Alabama sheriff who then just beat him, and while he was just expressing love, And there's a story. There's another documentary I strongly recommend that you can find on HBO called King in the Wilderness. And it's about the last 18 months of Dr. King's life. And for whatever reason, it didn't get a lot of publicity, but it's incredibly well made. And it centers around the last 18 months of his life. Andrew Young tells a story about how when Dr. King was in Chicago, any student of his life, all of the books about his life focus on his attempt to achieve racial justice in Chicago as one of the great disappointments. He couldn't get the change he wanted. He got a minor group of accommodations to end the marching, and the racism that he found in Chicago and the Chicago suburbs, he would later describe as just as bad as anything he had to deal with in Mississippi when they were trying to integrate neighborhoods, change the way these housing rules were, that African-Americans couldn't buy homes or they couldn't get mortgages, or they called it redlining, this whole system that wasn't enforced by law, but by business practice, that had the same result as legal segregation. And how they were marching and there were hundreds and hundreds of angry white racists screaming racial epithets at them. And Andrew Young, who later became the mayor of Atlanta and a very distinguished career, but at that time he was one of the key lieutenants of Dr. King, said that this a woman came right up to King with her veins bulging, screaming racial epithets at him that I would not repeat. And King just looked at her and said, "You're too beautiful to be so mean." And Young said about 15 minutes later, she came back to him weeping and apologized.
Really?
You know, wow. And, you know, these are saints in the body of human beings. You know, these are people who have flaws. All of these people have their flaws, their egos, their imperfections. That's the nature of, human birth is my experience. It is anyway. But actually channel saintly energy into these incredibly difficult situations. And, you know, I think that's kind of what holds our world and civilization together from going into a total dystopian chaos. And, you know, to recognize the people who've embodied that, you know, is a way that we can all be inspired by. There are still people doing this kind of work. I mean, I know you lived in North Carolina for a long time, and Reverend Barber, to me, is someone who does this kind of work and embodies this kind of spirit. And there are many people who aren't famous, but who do it in their moment to moment or day to day life. But having these famous role models are really useful, because it's not so easy as you know, to love everybody. It's one thing for your guru to tell you to love everybody. It's another thing to actually do it.
Yeah.
And to see people who do it when their physical lives are threatened and when their careers are threatened, and who do it because they have this unshakable conviction that that's who they are as beings, you know, is really, I find very, very helpful.
Yeah. And how about in terms of practice, what you preach? There was an incident that happened with John Lewis, where he described when he was a young man, he was beaten bloody by members of the Ku Klux Klan after attempting to enter a white waiting room. And many years later, this was in February 2009, one of the men that had beaten him came to Capitol Hill. He was in, by that time, this Ku Klux Klan member was in his 70s, and he had with him his son in his 40s. And he said, "Mr. Lewis, I'm one of the people who beat you and your seatmate on a bus." And the man said he had been in the KKK. He said, "I want to apologize. Will you accept my apology?" And he did. And then he hugged the father and the son, and they all just cried together. And John said, "It is the power in the way of peace, the way of love. We must never, ever hate. The way of love is a better way." So talk about love, everyone. Like,
so beautiful. Is this from that same book?
No. This is something else I picked up on some other.
Very, reference. Very beautiful. Thank you. I hadn't heard that story. That's so beautiful.
Yeah. Another thing which has nothing to do with his quote unquote saint saintliness, whatever. Saint is, it's a word that everybody understands. But yeah. The power of his practice of presence even in the face of the most horrible things. You know, we saw that movie, you know, both of us in the last couple of days, and the lunch counter scene. Yeah. Where they went in and they get kicked and beaten, and then they just pick themselves up to get back into the seat. I mean, this kind of commitment, and you hear John Lewis going, it's a matter of bringing love into it in that moment. I mean, just...
No, and this tradition of believing in nonviolence, it's a philosophy which hasn't been particularly trendy. You know, there's a certain glamour about by any means necessary. I respect the emotion and the sense of justice that propels that, but it isn't to me as high a calling as nonviolence. There are people that whose names we'll never know that passed on these teachings. Some of them were Quakers. I first became familiar with nonviolent theory from the American Friends Service Committee that was active in the nonviolent side of the struggle against the war in Vietnam. And of course, you know, Dr. King, you know, was urged by many other civil rights leaders and almost all Democrats not to oppose the war in Vietnam because they said it would undermine his struggle for racial justice. And he said, how can I tell gang members in Chicago not to be violent if I'm not against our country being violent? You know, don't you know me? You know, he was incredible. Yeah, again, in this film, King in the Wilderness, this was the other big issue he dealt with the last year of his life. And John Lewis the same way. You know, these are amazing, amazing people. And many of them have passed to the other side. They're kind of the greatest generation. They're another greatest generation of the African-American greatest generation. Not that any generation has a monopoly on greatness, but that group that were able to be the vehicles for that step in the American story were amazing, amazing people. Mm. And now we're at another crossroads, and we have to recognize the beauty in people in real time when they're doing it. It's a little easier after they're dead, and or if they're very, very old. It's a little harder in real time when the issues and are so intense, and everybody's own sense of security is threatened by being, you know, too controversial.
Yeah, right, exactly. And the other thing with John Lewis, I was going to say before that I saw, this is something else I saw on the net, probably on social media. It's one thing for him, which is a phenomenal thing, as I said, the kind of presence that he had to enact the words that he spoke. He was active. He did action. Mm. It wasn't bullshit. No. But then at another level, and we're talking now about, you know, a highly spiritual person, I saw a little film, Amici. You know Amici, the hugging saint from India?
Yes, I'm familiar with her, yes.
Yeah. So she apparently went to Washington, and they set up a meeting. I guess she wanted to meet John Lewis. And they show a film of them meeting up, and her thing is, you know, loving and hugging people. Mm. And she did that with him. He's so in the moment. He just started crying, and he asked for his assistant gave him a handkerchief, and he was so in the moment with the depth of just loving and being loved by this
Where is that footage?
I'll try and find it and send it. You guys that are out there going to do the show notes here, and you're listening to this to figure out what to do. Okay,
must be on find YouTube that, somewhere. Find us the link.
Yeah. Amici and John Lewis. And
I would love that link. That's incredible. I didn't know about that. I'm not surprised, but I didn't know it existed, you know.
Just another example of the man's enormous presence in the moment.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
All the way to him. You see in the film that we saw, which is Good Trouble, right? Is that the name of the film?
Good Trouble. Good Trouble.
Him dancing to some really cool tune. And
Pharrell,
he was really
Get
good.
Happy. Yeah, there was the Pharrell song, Get Happy.
Oh, yeah, the Pharrell song.
He was well into his 70s, and still, you know, exuded this joy in his dancing.
No, but he was a great dancer. You know, every little move was just perfect. Just another reflection of who he is. Yeah. So another interesting thing, given the foundation and the websites and the podcast network that we represent, Ramdas.org, Be Here Now Network. So I have been doing a number of different podcasts with people like Conda Mason. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her, but she's part of Jack Kornfield's Spirit Rock, but has been an advocate. She's one of those people that you might not have heard of. She's been working on this her entire life. Mm-hmm. And she's going to start doing some podcasts, everybody, by the way, real shortly. So look out for her. She's just a fantastic person. So as I do these things, we're getting a little bit of pushback from our audience, not a lot, but enough to make it worthwhile for me to even prompt you about this, which is Ramdas, this, you know, all Black Lives Matter, all lives matter. And that's not particular to our audience. That's particular. That happens out there. It's happening across the country, you know, the reactivity of that with some people. And what have you thought about this? Have you heard about this? And it's a difficult thing. Of course, Ramdas himself was a major social action advocate. And we actually have a whole series that he did that we found from the 80s called Reaching Out, which we're going to share with people about his advocacy.
Oh, nice. I'd love to check
that out. Yeah, I'll let you know.
I'm not surprised knowing him a bit, but I didn't know that existed, those things.
Yeah.
Well, I don't exactly understand. Is the nature, I mean, the idea of Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter is, it's like somebody gave the example that if someone had come up to me after my dad died and said, instead of saying, I'm sorry your dad died, they'd say, gee, you know, well, sorry, anybody has to die. You know, it's like, or if somebody says to you, I love you, and you say, well, I love everybody, you know, it's not true to the situation that we're in the country. There is a disproportionate vulnerability that African Americans have. This is statistically proven by every metric there is, whether it's a killing of police officers or mortality rates, there's just an overwhelming fact that the legacy of slavery did not end with the Emancipation Proclamation. It did not end with the passage of civil rights legislation. There's been progress, is no question. It's better, I think, to be African-American today than it was 50 or 100 or 200 years ago. But it's not, we haven't achieved the racial justice. It's much harder for a lot of us white people to recognize it, because if we don't feel racist and our friends aren't racist, we forget the venality and evil of the racism that does remain until we see something like that video of the murder of George Floyd. And then you start reading and remembering the disparity of incomes, the disparity of wealth, the disparity of opportunities. And, it's not very difficult to trace it to the legacy of legal segregation and unfair practices, disparity of educational opportunities, of health opportunities, and all sorts of other things. And so that's why the phrase Black Lives Matter exists, to recognize that truth. And while it's true that all lives matter, it's irrelevant in the conversation about the unique consequence of patterns of racism. And, then every African-American, no matter how well-educated or wealthy they are, has a story about a racist incidents in their life that white people never have to go through. And that's a reality and a consciousness raising that is the goal, as I understand it, of a lot of the movement that's going on now. Now, does that relate to spirituality? can you say, gee, if you don't believe these political ideas, you're not really spiritual? No, because I am only a limited human being, and I only have the idea that I have at this moment, and I've changed my mind about a lot of things over the years, and I think it's important to honor how much we don't know, and to honor that God created the entire human race, including people whose politics we disagree with. But at the same time, faith without works, they say in the Christian world, is incomplete. If you don't live by the idea of loving everybody, if you don't live by those things in terms of the way you treat other people, then you're disconnected from that part of reality. And our mutual friend Bernie Glassman talked a lot about this in the context of Buddhism, where his views about having a social conscience were also very controversial, as I understand it, in the traditional Buddhist world. And he formed something new called the Zen Peacemaker's Order to actualize his belief that he could be true to all of the classical Buddhist meditation and the transmission from his teacher that he had received, and still process that through the perception of having love and empathy for all beings, including those who were suffering, and to act in an ethical manner, and that ethics are also a subdivision of spirituality. Now, that doesn't mean that two people who are ethical and spiritual might not come to different political conclusions. Absolutely true.
Yeah.
But I think each of us still needs to follow what our heart and mind tells us in real time is the spiritual thing to do, and not just have it be some separate part of ourselves that's disconnected. You know, I'm going to meditate and I'm going to merge with the light, but when I come down, I'm not going to notice a homeless person on the street or someone asking me for a quarter. That doesn't really work for me. Now, Dr. King was very preoccupied with this very issue in dealing with the white Christian community and some aspects of the black Christian community. And his famous essay, which was turned into a book, Letter from a Birmingham Jail, is about this. It's a letter to, that was in response to a statement from some white Christians who were criticizing the civil rights movement based on the idea that it was incompatible with pure religion. And he says it way better than I ever could. Another great document of his, much more cerebral than some of his sermons, but he could operate on multiple channels. So in the context of our community, look, I wouldn't tell anybody that, gee, to love Ram Dass and to follow his teachings is to vote a certain way or donate to somebody. But I think to follow his teachings is to recognize the world that you're in, your place in the world, the choices that you have in front of you, and not run away from them. And if you really deep in your heart come to a different conclusion than I do, that's the way God made each of us. But if you try to escape from dealing with these things in the name of spirituality, to me, that's not consistent with the Ram Dass that I knew.
Yeah.
Is that responsive to what you were saying?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I just saw something recently that he said, which was, if you're doing nothing, you are doing something. And that's an interesting statement from him. In this training that I taught, it's Robin DiAngelo, by the way, who wrote the book White Fragility.
Okay.
And yes. In the training, you know, it's just identifying, are you racist? No, I'm not racist. My best friend is a black person, or, you know, that kind of response. And then at one point she said, the truth though, is if you're not doing something actively, and it's not getting elected to Congress and trying to change the voting rights laws, but it's just a small kindness in your neighborhood. It's giving and supporting a black store, owned store, whatever it may be. She said, if you're not doing this, then you are contributing to racism. So it's a pretty intense statement, and I'm sure, you know, there would be a lot of pushback around that. I even felt uncomfortable as I was in the thing, just interacting. And yet, the more that, and as you said, once this thing, people saw George Floyd being murdered the way that he was, once that happened, it seems impossible not to look into ourselves, not to educate ourselves, and how can we live in this kind of unjust society without some action?
Yeah, I think there's no denying that it's a tremendous, we're very complex beings, and the group of a few billion of us is unknowably complex. And I understand that any particular plan, any particular program, any particular teaching, you know, may have its limitations. And, you know, it's not about having some allegiance to some particular dogma or what some of the people like to call political correctness. I'm all for open-mindedness, but that has to be married to open-heartedness, suffering. And no matter what our opinions might have been about the last 30 or 40 or 50 years of American politics, we have to look in the mirror in 2020 and see we've made progress in some ways. We have African-American billionaires. We have African-American talk show hosts. We have obviously, you know, African-American president. That's better. But it's the overall situation in terms of the imbalance of wealth, the imbalance of educational opportunity, and the way people are treated in the criminal justice system is not moral. It's, there's something wrong. Now, to say something is systemic is not the same as knowing how to fix the system. And people of goodwill are going to have different opinions about how to fix the system. And there are a lot of very well-intentioned ideas that turned out to do as much harm as good. And then you move on to the next, you know. Mm. But the idea of ignoring that reality doesn't seem consistent to me with being a moral person in 2020.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. By the way, another little anecdote. We could try and think of some antidotes to this stuff. Yeah, is that when, because you mentioned Obama, when he was inaugurated on the first time, first inauguration, John Lewis just went up to him and he was just weeping, you know, at the extraordinary moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, Obama said to him, John, it's because of you.
Yeah, it's because of
you. It's because of you. And the weird thing is, 4 years later, this second inauguration, he went over, he remembered what he said. Yeah. He said, John, it's because of you.
Yeah. No, and I think he had Reverend Lawson. I think Obama had Reverend Lawson, who was also a nonviolent colleague of John Lewis's and Dr. King, who's still, I believe, alive, one of the, you know, in his 90s, speak. I didn't agree with every policy of President Obama, but I do feel he had very good intentions and was one of our better presidents, and he did honor the tradition that allowed him to be in that position. So again, I don't.
He honored being a human. Start there. Given what's going on right now.
So you know, again, I understand your dilemma of how to balance the inner work that we're doing and the idea of loving everybody, which means everybody, including people who, you know, don't want to wear a mask in public. You know, they're still God's creation, and there's some mystery why each of us are so different that we have to stay in that place. And one of the things I so learned from Ram Dass about was his commitment to that idea. Didn't he always have a Republican on his puja table
always,
the last 15
always.
Or 20 years?
Yes.
And that was his commentary on himself about knowing his biases and wanting to live up to what your guru told him, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And I don't think we can ever remember that too much. But that doesn't mean we don't try to act according to what our own conscience tells us in real time, in the moment. If it's what your conscience tells you, that's one thing. But if you're just trying to escape into some vague notion of spirituality at the expense of honoring what's right around you, that doesn't feel that spiritual to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree. And I'll have to make a little bit of an admission here, because we're talking about someone like John Lewis, who, as you said, I mean, had so many incidents where he was roughed up and beaten and in
he was jailed more than 40 times.
40 times. Yeah. Yeah.
One time is a lot.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was one time in a juvenile facility. That was once enough, was enough for me. Yeah. 40 times.
I know. And to know it's going to happen and be able to have the kind of equanimity and commitment and presence is extraordinary. So in thinking of all of this, I happen to, I have somebody else that I actually did a podcast with named Makad Brooks, who's an African-American actor. And I was introduced to him and I started following him. He's a major, we talked, he's been a proponent, a young man who's been a proponent of social justice, racial justice for a long time. And he started just putting some stuff up on his Instagram account. And so there was this one particular video, Danny, of a young African American in a car. And he was surrounded by police, one that was right looming at him in a very extraordinarily aggressive manner. And he, this young man, had his cell phone up and he was filming it. He had his cell phone in one hand and he was doing this. I am not doing anything. I'm respecting and cooperating, but I am videoing this and I ask you to, you know, respect my rights, something like that. Very even. And another two, as I said, two other policemen on each side of the car, and this really menacing officer. And kept threatening him, and he kept saying, "I'm not doing anything." And then eventually, what happens is, you can see the officer reach in and grab him, and just pull him literally by his neck out of the car. And of course, the video went. Actually, it kept playing, and you heard the commotion and so on and so forth. It was so effing horrible. And in it, I just talked about how John Lewis personally confronted this. And this is just me, you know, watching a video on social media and getting this enormous poison came up in me of, oh my God, I just, how can this be? And the hatred I felt in that moment to that policeman, who is obviously, I mean, been deluded from the time of his birth by his social circumstances, from parents.
Well,
and so
on. You know, look, I think my political views kind of have become clear through this conversation, and I'm not at all contradicting them. But I also, I do worry. Look, these video devices, first of all, they're here to stay. And I think it's much more good than not, because we wouldn't know what happened to George Floyd if there weren't a video. They would have made up some other story. No question about that. On the other hand, the ability to sort of excerpt things from videos and repeat them a million times, and even there's this possibility of altering them and so-called deep fakes that you know, I worry a little bit about when I feel that kind of agitation. From seeing something, reading something on Twitter, reading, you know, that I try to watch it inside myself, because first of all, it's only a piece of the truth. It's not the entire truth. And I do think that, look, I think police practices need to change. I think training needs to change. I think there are some people who have a badge and a gun who shouldn't have them. I think practices like chokehold should be outlawed. I'm in favor of reallocating resources and most of the progressive shopping list. But I also do think it's important to recognize the humanity of people who serve in the police. I think I've had many, you know, that some of them have had very personal experiences that make them scared and on edge. maybe 5 minutes before the video took place, maybe five years before. That doesn't mean that there's any justification for patterns of racist behavior, but I also believe to recognize the humanity of people in that job is part of what's going to make things better. And it's challenging depending on the circumstance and the situation. But, you know, I'm not trying to compare these things because the crisis of racism is correctly front and center right now in the national conversation. But in dealing with it and trying to evolve into a better outcome instead of just winning an argument, I think bearing in mind what it's like to have those jobs, they're not particularly well paying. Now they, some people admire them more, some people admire them less. They have children, they have, you know, it's not, they're just part of a broader social situation. And policemen, because we've cut budgets for mental health, we've cut budgets for education, for recreation, that all of these problems end up being on the doorstep of a police department. And, you know, social work, all these other things going down. So somehow I'm trying in my own head to be completely committed to the progressive policy goals, honor and search myself to be as, it's not just racism, sexism and the problem that women raised in the last few years, also a big deal that should be recognized. You know, homophobia, also a big deal that should be recognized. And but at the same time, to try to recognize the humanity and good intentions of people that may not come to the same conclusions that I do or have jobs that I've never done. I don't know how to synthesize it. Well, I know who I'm voting for. I know who I'm giving money to. I think we do the little things we can do without, you know, overthinking it. But then somehow coming back to a place of compassion and love is the only way out of this conundrum, because we know what happens if we up the ante of negativity. You know, we know what those results are.
And that's
that's what John Lewis embodied was that philosophy of not upping the ante of negativity. And so to honor him, we have to honor that part of him as well as the civil rights part of him.
And that's
and somehow fuse them together. Not easy to do, but as we've said in other conversations, that's the gig.
But that's the, that is the spiritual work. That is why this is all one ball of wax. There isn't two separate anything. And that I encountered that feeling in that moment, and then I had I then went inside and did what we would hope anybody would do, to realize, as His Holiness says, everyone wants the same thing. They want to be happy. They want to have sustenance. They want peace. Everybody on this planet wants the same thing. And to recognize that is a help to cut through the us and them thing.
And the
even
other
in,
thing,
even in this very, very pernicious situations that we have seen.
Well, and there is a potential silver lining, not to trivialize the gravity of the problems and the amount of work it'll take to really build a just society. But, you know, the reaction of the majority of the public to George Floyd is very different than it was to Rodney King and previous times when there were racial disturbances based on police issues. It's two-thirds of the society and probably 80% of young people are empathizing with Black Lives Matter. That's a that was not have been the case even 10 years ago. So for all of the darkness that's been going on and that we see manifest, you know, on our computer screens so often, there's something good been going on also that could end up prevailing based on, you know, public opinion is more progressive and enlightened, I think, than it's been you know, in some time. And translating that into actions and good structures in a very complicated world where money is such a driving force, not easy, but I do find that very, very encouraging. Yeah. And I think a lot of African American leaders have commented on that also. So there are some real rays of light. And I think the idea is to try to support, you know, the light and to try to avoid freaking out as best we can. Right.
Well, we're at the end of our time here, and here's a last thing from John Lewis address exactly what we're talking about. He said, "Do not get lost in a sea of despair. Mm. Be hopeful, be optimistic. Mm. Our struggle is not the struggle of a day, a week, a month, or a year. It is the struggle of a lifetime. Mm. Never, ever be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble, necessary trouble." And that's the title of this. That's what he used to say. Everyone said he was getting some good trouble, eh? Yeah. You know, everybody he was around. So
really, really great, Raghu. I think you're always a good curator of quotes, but I think this may be one of your best. All of these have been so just filled with light. Thank you for letting me listen to them and have this conversation with you. And all love to everyone listening.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, everybody. You'll be able to go up to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling, and you will see all of the links and everything else to some of the stuff that we've been talking about, including this film, King in the Wilderness. I want to see that. I haven't seen
it. Oh, I can't wait for you to see it. You've got to call me after you see it. It's incredible. It's so spiritual. It's one of a kind. It's one of my favorites.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to do that. And by the way, Danny, for those of you who might not know, is the author of a number of different books around our culture, all of them just wildly great as far as I'm concerned. And he's working on another one now, but maybe too soon to talk about, a little later down the road.
Yeah, a little later. It'll come out next year. It covers some of the stuff we're talking about, but I got a lot of work to do before anyone can read it.
So we'll give you a couple of links for Danny's books as well. And again, thank you so much. As usual, we shall see you all next week on Mind Rolling.